This is Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Your feedback helps us know what we're doing right and what we need to work on. Make sure to send us ideas for guests and programs, too. Today, I'm talking with Reason's own Ronald Bailey about his incredible new story from the new issue of Reason's print magazine. Ron is, you see, originally from the Appalachian area of Western Virginia, and in the story called Stuck, he returns to his old stamping grounds to ask, why don't people who live in areas with no opportunities just leave? You can find Stuck at Reason.com, and if you found J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy interesting, you'll really want to read Ron's story. Ron Bailey, thanks for joining the Reason Podcast.
Delighted to be with you.
So you went back, actually, not to your hometown exactly, but to your grandparents' home county of McDowell County, West Virginia. Talk a little bit about what it was like growing up in the basic area where you did, and what did it feel like to go back to that general region?
Sure. I went back to McDowell County because that's where my great-grandfather, my grandfather, and my father all grew up. They grew up in Panther, West Virginia, and I spent a good deal of my boyhood going over to visit relatives in McDowell County, West Virginia. My grandfather basically left McDowell County around 1950, and all six of his grown children eventually moved over to Washington County, Virginia, which is where I grew up on a dairy farm. But I was very familiar with McDowell County. We went over a lot to visit properties and relatives that my grandparents still owned over there, and visited relatives a lot. But I hadn't been back for more than 40 years, and the idea came to me to go see what was happening there. I'd been reading some recent data, for example, that from Ann Case and Angus Deaton at Princeton University, where they had discovered that mortality was increasing among poor white Americans. In fact, that the life expectancy was declining and the likelihood of dying was going up. And I keep in touch, so to speak, with the news about McDowell. It shows up occasionally in the news as a pretty sad place. And it turns out that McDowell County is the county in the United States that has the lowest male life expectancy in America.
Wow. So what is that? Do you know offhand? Or do you remember?
It's about 63.4 years.
And this was
By the way, it has the distinction of having the second lowest female life expectancy.
Wow.
Which is around 73 years.
And this is an overwhelmingly white area, and it's poor white Appalachian kind of mountain folk then, right?
Yes, basically. About 9% of the county is black, but most of the county is white folks who've been there for quite some time.
And they are, they're dying at 63, 64, 65 on average, male and female. What are they dying from?
Initially, of course, it would be, I think basically what you can say is that it's because of the results that Ann Case and Angus Deaton had, which is essentially it's an increase of despair. People are opioid addiction is a huge problem in the area, for example, and there's a lot of overdose deaths. There's also a lot of drunkenness, a lot of people dying of various kinds of accidents, and there's also a high level of suicide.
Wow. And then I assume that there's probably, or maybe not, but higher than average alcohol, or rather tobacco consumption, obesity, and other kind of lifestyle issues that tend to shorten people's lives.
That's also true.
So you write in the piece in Stuck, which again I highly recommend to everyone because it's both it's extremely well written, as all of your stuff is, Ron, but it's also incredibly poignant. You write that it had been 40 years since you'd been there, but you had always felt like an outsider, even when you were growing up. Why did you feel that way, and what set you apart?
Well, in the particular case, in the article, I felt like an outsider in the sense that a lot of the folks that we would be visiting when I was a kid seemed a lot poorer than I was or my family was. Though, relatively speaking, it turns out that my family was pretty poor as well.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense, it was a contrast between And I didn't get this into the article, but one of the ways I thought about it is that there is a distinction, and it came to me, and I was talking to folks there on this last trip in September, is there's a distinction between the sort of people who are property owners, which is the way my family evolved over time. They're basically more self-sufficient and independent, and the sort of people who work as employees, especially for employees in extraction industries. They seem much less entrepreneurial and more dependent over time. And I think that that's the way it played out over time, is that my family became, such as it is, property owners of a dairy farm and other stuff. And a lot of the folks who stayed there, basically when the jobs disappeared from the coal mining industry, they didn't move. They didn't try to better themselves in certain ways. So there was a mental distinction there.
Yeah. I guess this is, I'm thinking back, I think our grandparents were of roughly similar vintage and whatnot, but my parents and grandparents grew up poor in urban areas in New York and Waterbury, Connecticut. And they were poor in a particular way. I doubt that they made less money than your grandparents might have. But if you owned a farm, at the very least, it meant that you could grow your own food and you could feed yourself pretty comfortably, right?
Oh, absolutely. At least 90% of the food I ate growing up was stuff that we raised on our farms. We had basically 2 acres of garden, and we had cows, sheep, goats, pigs,
and
chickens, ducks, geese, whatever.
That explains your aversion to the great outdoors, right? I mean, that must have been horrible as a child to have to, because I assume you were working that 2 acre garden all the time.
Absolutely.
What about the role of welfare? I mean, when you left, I assume this was in the early stages of either or after LBJ's Great Society programs had come to Appalachia. And of course, you know, both Lyndon Johnson and Robert Kennedy made, you know, very public displays of caring about poor white people, particularly in Appalachia. It's always been known as one of the poorest regions in America, or at least in the 20th century. When you were growing up, was there the type of kind of universal relief of food stamps and welfare that there is now, or was that being handled at the local level or the state level as opposed to the federal level? Or is that something new that is different than, say, 40 or 50 or 60 years ago?
You must recall I was a kid then, but basically one of the things that became apparent is my relatives were extremely disdainful, my parents and my grandparents were of people who would take federal government aid. And it was being rolled out at the time, and particularly during the Great Society period, and a lot of the folks that we knew in McDowell County took advantage of that, so to speak. They became enmeshed in the welfare system is another way to look at it. It should be remembered that the first food stamps in America were dispensed in McDowell County in 1961. So it's been a long-term kind of situation in that area.
So you talked about the economists who suggest that despair is kind of the leading cause of shortened lifespans among poor whites, which makes me think of there's a Saul Bellow novel called More Die of Heartbreak. It almost is kind of resonant of that. How does the despair play out, particularly if poor people now are not necessarily, you know, they're not wanting in a way that they might have been in, you know, in the 50s, in the 40s, in the 30s for material comforts in terms of, you know, they have enough food to eat. They do have some kind of housing. They do have clothing and things like that. Where is the despair coming from?
Well, again, you have to think about it the other way is that a huge proportion of the people in the county don't actually have jobs. One of the heartbreaking statistics is that nearly 50% of the kids do not live with a biological parent, and over 80% live in households where no one works. And largely a lot of those households are grandparents and great-grandparents who are taking care of the kids. So that's part of the reason they're not working. But it's also a lot of their parents are enmeshed on disability and welfare, et cetera, et cetera. But the despair is Again, it's my interpretation. The despair is the result of not having anything worthwhile to do. And so a lot of the people actually are obese, as you point out. There were fascinating statistics on the amount of exercise. It kind of amazes me what the government will collect. But in McDowell County, West Virginia, has one of the worst rates of actual physical exercise in the state, which means, of course, that leads to obesity, heart disease, all kinds of other problems. And so if you're sitting on the couch watching television and occasionally taking a sip of beer and to down your opioids, you're going to have a problem.
Talk, you mentioned in the story, I think it was a grandmother who was taking care of a child.
Beverly Schlegel.
Yeah, talk a little bit about her story, and there's a particularly, I mean, there's a lot of heartbreak in this story. It's very sobering and disturbing, but where she talked about why she was taking care of the people she was.
Right. She's a great-grandmother in her 70s, and she and her husband actually moved away and took jobs in Ohio and in Michigan, and her husband, after a couple of decades of work, got injured on the job at a factory in Michigan, and they came back to West Virginia because that's what they knew and that's where family was. She actually said that she wished she had never come back, but then they got enmeshed in their family, and one of her granddaughters had her first baby at age 15 and is now 22 and has had three different children by three different boyfriends. And this great-grandmother has taken responsibility for two of them. She's adopted one of them, a little girl, and she's managed to get legal custody of a little boy. The third child is living with the father at this point. And her daughter is a, quote, home health care worker, but Beverly rolls her eyes when she says that. Basically says she watches out over old people, and apparently she has, quote, unquote, back problems and is addicted to opioids herself. So, and it's not taking care of the kids. And she basically, Beverly says, you know, if she could, she would get up and leave. She just feels too rooted to go away at this point. And she would take the kids with her. And it's kind of a brave situation. I mean, here's a woman who you would think would be at the point of being able to enjoy her golden years or something and relax, go on vacations maybe, or go visit friends. And instead, she's raising children.
Yeah. You meet a number of people who are working in McDowell County to help people to kind of either revive the area or, do job placement. Talk about some of them, and what are their odds of success?
Well, Kathy Witt was an incredibly impressive figure. She's been involved with the social welfare systems, as I call her. If there is a commissar for that kind of situation in McDowell County, Kathy's it. And the truth is that she's been doing this for a long time, and you could, in a weird way, you could feel how tired she was of it. And as she says, as a quote in the article, she says, "We've really seen some dark days. I do not feel we have a good future based on where we are now. I think that McDowell County will continue to deteriorate." And she's retiring. And one of the things that she was despairing of, she was saying, who are the people coming behind her? Who are the ones who are going to step into her shoes to try to help make the situation better? And basically, she thinks that the generation of 24 to 45-year-olds is essentially lost, that they're simply not taking responsibility, and she doesn't expect them to do that. And so she's kind of really despairing about the situation there.
What is it about What is it about that age group, that they're not taking responsibility? Is it that they don't remember a time before, you know, a kind of post-apocalyptic landscape, or is it that they've gotten out, or what,
Well, the one thing when I did ask the question, and I should make this clear, is that why don't people leave? The fact of the matter is that 80% of the people have left. In 1950, there were 100,000 people living in McDowell County, and it was a fairly prosperous county. It was the major coal county in the United States at the time, and now it's down to below 20,000 people. So most people got out, like my relatives, like my grandparents did, mm-hmm. and my father did.
And did they leave because, I mean, there was a sense that there were better opportunities elsewhere, or that people, or maybe a mix, that people recognized that coal was, you know, or the major industries were going to be, or they were declining, or they were in a sunset period?
That's an extremely good question. Again, I don't have my relatives to ask why they left, mm-hmm. though it is curious because they left at about the same time that a major innovation in coal mining took place, where it was the continuous belt mining, which reduced the number of workers needed to extract coal. And so that was the first beginning of the first great layoff. And so perhaps it was coincidental, but it might have been related to that as well. In any case, they went over the mountains and moved into Virginia to become dairy farmers. But going back to your earlier question, there's a very impressive guy that I got to chat with. His name is Donald Reed, and he's with West Virginia Extension. And one of the things that he's doing, he's very proud of that. He's only in his 30s. I think he's about in mid-30s. And he came back to McDowell County to try to help. And what he's, among the other things he's doing, but he's the head of their 4-H program, which he managed to get started. And now they've enrolled 800 kids in the county, all under age 13 as part of the 4-H program. And you know, it's a program that it does try to teach kind of self-sufficiency and do gardening, how to fix food, how to do camping. It's actually a pretty good program. I actually was a 4-H member when I was a kid.
What do the 4-H's stand for, Ron? Do you remember?
Heart, health, hands, and head, I believe.
Okay. And were you also a future farmer of America, or were those?
I was
like
not because I had. Early figured out I was not going to be a future farmer, so no.
You said that about 80% of the people left, and that gets to the subtitle to your story asks, you know, why don't people leave? And you answer at one point in your story, the short answer is that they did leave. What separates the people who leave and the people who stay? And then is this kind of, I mean, it's obviously tragic that anybody in America today is living, you know, is having a shrinking, you know, is living less or for a shorter period of time than their parents, much less their grandparents' generations, I think. But is there, you know, is there something substantially different? And then is it kind of heritable where if your parents didn't get out in the 50s or your grandparents didn't get out in the 50s, you're going to stay there forever and kind of close, you know, turn the last light off?
I think that there might be a kind of generational transmission, you will, of expectations and despair and so forth, that you still, when I was talking to folks there was still this weird hope that somehow the coal industry would come back and it would bring prosperity with them. But on the other hand, you talk to people, to give an example that didn't make it into the story, but I was talking with folks about cleaning up the streams in McDowell County. I want to stress, by the way, McDowell County is actually physically a beautiful, beautiful place. Mm-hmm. But the roads and the stream size are clotted with garbage. People just throw stuff out. Kathy Witt, with whom I was speaking earlier, was telling me that she knew people who would put the garbage on their back porch overlooking the creek and then wait for the flood to come and throw it out. I know.
And by the way, in a way, this is kind of a return to an early America, right? I mean, before the litter bug was created as a public service campaign and stuff. I have some memories of driving down the highway with my parents, and this was in New Jersey, so it's a different kind of locale. But where you know, if you were eating in the car, you would just throw stuff out the window, and nobody thought twice about it.
Yep, yeah. There's kind of that. But this example is that they're trying to clean up the streams, and so they've hired people paying $15 an hour to do it. And I was flat out told we couldn't find anybody in the county who would take the job, so they're actually busing in people from the next door county, Mercer County, to clean up the streams.
Wow. So The people who left, your family and many more like them, they wanted to get out and do something different with their lives. But then, I mean, is there a kind of constellation of personality traits that define the people who stayed behind? Or is it, are they, I don't want to say that they were unmotivated or they were unambitious or anything, but why would people choose to stay behind when it was clear that other people, that most of your kind of cohort was doing something different and it was paying off for them?
That's an incredibly good question, and I don't really have I don't know if I have a psychological insight to it. I do think that it's rooted in two things, which is that it's what you're used to, and people just don't like to move if they don't have to. And the second part is that, and I try to make the case in the article, that at this point, basically the government is paying poor people to stay there, basically to stay poor. And so there's a huge constellation of benefits, all of which are meager, but if you add them up, it's enough to cobble together, enough of a living so you have food and a rickety house to live in or a trailer to live in, and you don't have to do very much. So,
and let's be clear. I mean, what you're talking about here, I'm thinking back to, it was rarely leveled against white kind of welfare recipients, but in the 80s when Ronald Reagan would sometimes paint generally fanciful pictures of welfare queens and welfare bucks kind of living large on it. It really isn't that at all. It's you go through a lot of hoops for, as you said, a pretty meager existence, although it adds up. And it's like if you're kind of like Jughead Jones from the Archie comics or something, you can get by on it and you can kind of scratch out an existence where you don't have to work very much.
Right. I think that's about what it comes to. And once you get stuck in that, it's really hard, as far as I can tell, for you to get out of it, to change that cycle.
Is and part of the part of your story, which I think is really important, and again, both insightful and depressing, is that you were saying, the government is basically paying people to stay poor, and in parts of the story seem are reminiscent of Charles Murray's Losing Ground, which kind of laid out the logic of a welfare system, and this is what that book is 25 or 30 years old at this point. But the logic of a system where it really did pay people not to work, not to get married, not to save, all sorts of things. And you see that in the people that you're talking about in McDowell County. And then there's also a whole kind of geographical dimension to it, because part of the problem is that there's really nothing. I mean, you were saying there's nothing to do there. There aren't many jobs. And I guess there's the stream walking and stream cleaning, which is one thing. But, if people there are going to kind of flourish, they're going to probably have to leave West Virginia. But is it that the benefits are, even if they're federally kind of funded, they're doled out on the state level, and that it just becomes insuperable to figure out, okay, well, I'm going to get together enough money and say move to Texas or Florida or a boom state. What is it that what is the most pressing and obvious way to restructure a series of payments that might give people enough capital to actually move without kind of keeping them in some kind of meager existence?
Right. I guess the one way to think, the one way I thought about that, and I was looking around, is that how could you get the capital to go? Why would you cling to this? And one of the problems, as you pointed out, is that state benefits are essentially variable at every state level. So if you're a poor person in Alabama, you have to jump through these particular hoops to get it. You have to have these waiting times, and that's what. Same thing in West Virginia. So if you decided that you wanted to pick up stakes and go, they give you a little bit of money every month. That's not enough to get enough capital to go. And if you leave and you decide to go to Ohio, or better yet, to go to Texas, you're leaving behind whatever little bit of cash you might have had access to, and it's going to be a struggle no matter what. And I think that forms a psychological barrier, basically going, I've got the bird in the hand here in West Virginia, can't be sure of that bird over there in Texas. And so you are risk averse, and particularly if you're poor, you have to be risk averse because you don't know where the next dollar is going to come from.
Well, so there's a psychological barrier there, and I apologize if I know that you're not necessarily as fond of kind of social psychology as I might be, but there's also a sociological barrier in that. You know, when people migrate from, a town to town or a country to country, and I know this is certainly true of America, whether it was Europeans coming over in the early part of the 20th century or Mexicans and Central Americans coming over now, that a lot of the times they'll follow, somebody from a village or a relative goes and makes it in a town, in a different country or in a different state, and then they slowly kind of bring their relatives there.
Right.
I mean, is it that... and everybody in McDowell County, I assume, has relatives within a couple of degrees of kinship who have moved elsewhere, and they probably, see them on Facebook or, they're probably in more contact now with them than they would have been 20 or 30 years ago. But there isn't that kind of channel, or I guess another way of putting this, are people still leaving McDowell County at the same rate that they used to? Or is it that this is just like a remnant that's not going anywhere?
People are still leaving, and there are two routes out, particularly the main route out, of course, is for a lot of people is the military.
Mm-hmm.
But a surprising number of them come back once they've done a tour of duty or two in the military, interestingly. And the other route would be education. And there are people who go to college and basically go away as well. But that's, again, small. But if you look, and I was looking over the decades, the number of people in the population of the county, they still, every decade or so, a few thousand fewer people are living in the county, and they're not all dying. So some of them are, in fact, leaving. But with regard to your notion of sort of, if you will, anchor populations, where you could go to and relatives would take you in if you moved to Ohio or to Texas or whatever, interestingly, we haven't mentioned it yet, but J.D. Vance, well, I guess you did mention it, J.D. Vance's book, Hillbilly Elegy, describing precisely that situation with his relatives in Kentucky who had moved to Ohio factory town.
Yeah, to Middletown, Ohio.
Right, and the hillbillies would actually create distinct neighborhoods in places like Columbus or Dayton or so forth, and people would know.
Yeah.
In fact, I was very charmed at one point to learn that Cincinnati has a statute on the book that doesn't allow discrimination on the basis of race, gender, and Appalachian origin. But what happens, I think, and I think that Vance, he doesn't actually address this as well as this, that those ties have frayed over time. It used to be when, for example, when immigrant folk came to the United States, there was no system of government support available to anybody. So you had to depend on family. Now, if you get tired of somebody, a relative staying in your house, you could say, go to the shelter.
Right.
And you don't feel quite as guilty.
Let's stay on Hillbilly Elegy for a second, because I know you also reviewed that for Reason. And, first off, you come from the area that, is hillbilly land, right, or a part of the country.
Hillbilly, I'm a hillbilly.
Is hillbilly is it a slur? Is it an epithet? Is it a kind of, it can be anything depending on who's speaking?
Only we victims are allowed to use it.
Okay, so it's like the N-word or, WAP or, various other things. It's one thing if a member of the population is saying it, and it's something totally else if an outsider is saying it. What did you think of Vance's book? I mean, it was certainly probably the most talked about, or arguably the most talked about book of the past year. Why do you think it resonated, and did you think it captured something meaningful, or is it overpraised?
I don't think it's overpraised. I think that it hit the right moment, because it was during the presidential campaign that we all just finished suffering through, and people were trying to figure out what the white working class was going to do. And he was describing the dysfunctions of basically the white working class in Ohio in a very really elegiac way, in a very nice way. I mean,
it's actually almost the post working class, right? Because I mean,
he's a Yale law graduate.
Well,
so, yeah.
No, he worked and he got out, and I want to get to that kind of sense of like what it's like to kind of escape or to move away from these family and geographical systems. But what he's talking about a lot, and it reminded me quite a bit of The Glass Castle, another relatively recent memoir of somebody moving from. Ultimately,
McDowell County.
Yeah, that's right. To New York.
Yeah, her father and mother lived in the Glass Castle was actually in Welch, West Virginia.
Wow, the white working class, oftentimes in my experience, they're the ones who have the most trouble with people who you kind of are describing in your story, the people who are welfare layabouts, who won't work and who, given a choice in Vance, when you were talking about the stream, people cleaning up the stream for $15 a day, he has
an hour.
$15 an hour. Yeah. He has a stunning episode in his book where he's talking about when he was saving money. This was either to go to Ohio State or between Ohio State and Yale Law School, where he was working in a tile factory in Middletown. And the guy was paying $17-18 an hour, but he couldn't get anybody to work, more than a few days in a row without, skipping work or just refusing to come anymore. And in my experience, the white working class oftentimes really gets angry with people who refuse to take easy or obvious opportunities. So, I mean, did Hillbilly Elegy did your trip to McDowell County, did it give you any insight into the Trump voter? Because I don't get the impression that a lot of welfare people were voting for Trump. It was, people who were a little bit more prideful than that, it seems.
I actually made a conscious decision not to tie the article to any of the presidential election stuff, mm-hmm. So I didn't address it in the article. But I did go through the county driving around counting Trump signs.
Yeah.
And they were everywhere. I did see two libertarian signs, but they were Trump signs.
Well, you must have seen a fair amount of Gadsden flags, right? The coiled snake, don't tread on me.
Right, and it's kind of funny whenever you would see, and there were a lot of Confederate flags, which is kind of weird for West Virginia to think about it, because the state, it was carved out of the Confederacy.
Right.
But everywhere I saw a Confederate flag, right next to it was an American flag.
Yeah.
So, I agree with you that there is some resistance in the older white working class with regard to people refusing to work or taking advantage of government programs or as they as my relatives and it was certainly used a lot when I was in McDowell County, they're just too sorry to work.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's true. But then I reflect on the fact that right now, if you're looking at the right number, what is it? It's the percentage of able-bodied males who are in the working force is the lowest it's been in decades. It's 83%.
Yeah. And that's like people in prime working years, which
right,
I think
it's
24
to 45.
Yeah.
24 to 45.
Yeah. And do you, you mentioned the high levels of kind of disability claims that, are endemic. And I know where I live in Oxford, Ohio, a good chunk of the time, and I know people in the area and across the border in West Virginia who, I mean, I've hired them to do day labor who are on full disability. These are men in, between 25 and 55 or whatever, who can do work, but they're on full disability, oftentimes for things like anxiety. It's not even tied to like a back problem or sciatica or a physical dimension. Does that, and I know we've had similar conversations that I may be channeling too much of the male heritage of my mother's and father's family, but I mean, is it that if a man can get by without working, he will not work generally? Are we paying people, are we paying men especially, too much money not to work?
It's really hard again for me to speculate on the psychology of what's going on. I think that part of the problem is that despair notion again is that there's just not enough sense of what it means to be doing something that is worthwhile, I guess is the way to put it. And that gets into a whole lot of complexity of what the 21st century is like for being and operating as a man in the world today. And there are just lots of cross-cutting currents that are discouraging people from participating fully in society anymore and standing up and being a member of society.
Do you, and I mean, are the extremes worse now in the sense of, you know, 90% plus of people in America, including, you know, high levels of households that are below the poverty line, have cable or satellite TV? And you're seeing, you know, they have internet access. You're seeing, everybody has a cell phone. Like, you're seeing images of immense wealth and accomplishment in a way that, you know, I mean, it's kind of in your face. Do you, I mean, ultimately, does that have a kind of defeating element to it if you're in McDowell County and you're working, even getting $15 an hour to help clean up a stream, and you're just kind of like, it's not enough somehow, or it will never take you to, you know, a Beverly Hills mansion or something?
That may be, but I remember a line from my story, actually, about my Aunt Teens, one of my grandfather's daughters, who, when she was a young girl growing up in Panther, West Virginia, she visited a friend whose home was in Welch, was one of the nice brick houses up on the hillside, and they had a swimming pool. And she said, "I saw that, and I just thought to myself, one day, if they can have, I can have too."
Yeah.
And her attitude toward inequality was, "I'm going to get that."
Right. Well, talk a little bit about your own personal experience, or reflect on that, because you were among either the only one or one of few of your family that moved away. And I remember you talking quite memorably about, you know, the first time that you kind of came up out of the subway in New York, you knew you were home. What is it like to, you know, be that kind of person where you're dramatically a lack of ease where you're growing up? And then, you know, do you feel guilty about moving away? Do you feel like you could have done more for the people that were left behind? Is it a kind of good riddance thing? What's the complex of feelings and thoughts about that of your escape?
Well, the good news is I'm not a very self-reflective person, but the way I put it in the article is that my experience of the past is whatever the opposite of nostalgia is. I don't pine for the past. I understand my past, and I understand how it created me and shaped me in certain ways. And it actually made me a fairly independent person for all kinds of reasons. But, you know, the thing is that growing up on a dairy farm as a relatively poor kid going to, you know, pretty mediocre high school, one's imagination and your access to books is what saves you, essentially. I also want to give a shout out to television. We only got one channel, and we only had a black and white television for most of the time when I was growing up. But that little box, you could see the possibility that other people were living other lives. And I know it sounds ridiculous, but I was fascinated by watching the Danny Thomas show, because I kept wondering, they're living in this wonderful apartment, and what did he do for a living?
Yeah. So that is at least one cheer for TV, which, of course, for our entire lives has I guess lately it's been surpassed as, you know, by the internet or video games as the absolute cause of everything wrong and sick in American society. But TV in your case then was, you know, it was a window onto
world.
A wider world. Yeah. So yeah. Do you expect to go back anytime soon to McDowell County?
I don't know. I've been threatening to take my wife Pamela Friedman down to visit now that I've been back. I mean, what really struck me as a kid, I didn't really think about it. But when I, you know, now in my dotage, I noticed how absolutely beautiful, I mean, physically beautiful, the mountains of West Virginia are. And there's a lot of things that to look at in that way. But on the other hand, you know, if you want to go to mountains on the East Coast, you could always go to Asheville and have fine dining available. Whereas mm-hmm. the best you can find in Welch, West Virginia at this point is a KFC. So. Yeah.
Well, we will leave it there. I want to thank you, Ron Bailey, for obviously years of great writing at Reason, but especially your most recent story in the January print edition of Reason, Stuck, where you bravely return home and kind of figure out what's going on in the part of the country that you left. Thank you so much, Ron.
Thank you for letting me appear on the podcast.
Yeah. This has been the Reason Podcast. I am Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. It'll help us know what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong. Thanks for listening.